Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm very appreciative of your time. Glad you've joined us as we continue to go through the big old binder of baseball cards, and it's been a fun journey. Here we are now, 75 plus episodes of this podcast. Started in the 1980s, moved into the 90s, the early 90s, the glorious days of the junk wax era. And by popular demand, going through the big old binder, the collection of cards I have from 1954 through 1980. And we're moving on to one of my favorite sets from this time of baseball card collecting, 1962, as we continue our chronological march now through the 60s, and later on we'll get into the 70s. But this week, taking a look at 62 Tops and taking a look at that sharp-dressed kid on card number 167 of the 62 Tops set. Yes, everyone's favorite color analyst, Tim McCarver, his rookie card in 62 Tops. Of course, that's a little misleading. He actually made his major league debut at the age of 17 in 1959, but after going back and forth between the minor leagues and the major leagues, starting to stick around in the early 60s, and we'll talk a little bit about Tim McCarver and his time. He actually had a very good career, won a couple of World Series, was very instrumental in the Phillies kind of riding the ship in the late 1970s, even though he wasn't part of their postseason roster in 1980 when they did win the World Series. But very interesting story about his career and, of course, his post-baseball career doing color analysis on baseball games for, about 35 years before he finally stepped aside from the spotlight, but still very active in the broadcasting world these days. Now, before we talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, some housekeeping to do, and we've got plenty of it to do it here. For those of you who are just tuning into Wax Ecstatic, just found out about it, I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Again, hi, how are you? So glad that you could join us here, and glad that you found the podcast. And we've got some new platforms for listeners to tune into the podcast with new episodes every Tuesday. And we also do a Flashback Friday edition, which we tweet out on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. But of course, you can find all of our archive programs on our platforms. Our main hosting platform is audioboom.com or AudioBoom. But if you go to the AudioBoom app or audioboom.com, type in Wax Ecstatic, you'll find us there. We're also heard on iTunes and iHeartRadio. And now, two more ways that you can listen via the Stitcher app and via the TuneIn app. So, to recap on the apps, we've got AudioBoom, you've got iTunes, you've got iHeartRadio, you now have Stitcher, you now have TuneIn. So there you go, five different ways, in addition to just following us on Twitter and clicking on the link that we send out on Tuesdays and Fridays. You can listen to new episodes and archive episodes on Stitcher and TuneIn, as well as iTunes, iHeartRadio, and AudioBoom. So thanks again to Stitcher and TuneIn for approving us. And we're growing our audience here. And it's great to see so many new followers and listeners. And we appreciate you joining in through all of our episodes, whether they're brand new every Tuesday as we go through the big old binder, or if you go digging through the archives, finding your favorite set or maybe even your favorite player that we talk about on the episodes. Now, also, you've seen a couple of tweets over the last few days, and you'll see a few more moving forward, but I don't want to hit people too hard over the head with this. We've set up a tip jar, and this was actually a suggestion from a few of our listeners during our listener survey, which we did a couple months ago. Some people were just like, you know what, I like the podcast so much, I actually want to pay for it. And this, of course, begs the question, well, do we take Wax Ecstatic and make it a subscription service? No, you know, we've gotten bigger, we've gotten better, we've grown quite a bit over the last few months, but we're certainly not at the stage where we're going to charge $4.99 at the door or whatever it is to listen to a podcast. So we're basically setting up a tip jar, and we're going to send out that link at Wax and Gum Stains throughout the next few weeks. And basically, it's just a link to a PayPal account. Once, maybe twice a week over the next few weeks, you'll see that pop up. And it's open to anybody who wants to make a cash donation, and we don't have a set amount. You can give us 5 cents, you can give us $5, you can give us $500, whatever. But whatever you feel is appropriate for your consumption of Wax Ecstatic, or, you know, it's a tip jar, so it's kind of an attaboy. You know, if you go to a restaurant or a bar and you're given exemplary service, you want to give that person a few extra bucks to say thanks for doing so well. Same thing, too, you know, with an Uber driver or a taxi driver. You know, anywhere you see that tip jar, if you feel motivated to give a couple bucks for the fine work that he or she does, then, you know, you put in just kind of what you're feeling. So if it's just the attaboy tip, you know, here's a few dollars, thank you very much, or it's, hey, I've listened to every episode, or I listened to this more than Netflix, or, you know, well, I've listened to 58 of 75 episodes, so here I am catching up here. Whatever that amount is, we appreciate it. We thank you in advance. We got a few donations already right off the bat. I'm not going to name names, but you know who you are, and I thank you very much for making those contributions early on. And you're more than welcome to make multiple contributions, or like I said, if you just want to throw in one just because, you know, hey, good job, there you go, I appreciate it. Now, something about the tip jar, too, again, regardless of, you know, what amount you want to put in, and, you know, not everybody has to put something in. I mean, it's a true tip jar. We're not just charging a flat fee across the board for this podcast. But the more that we accumulate through the tip jar over the next few weeks, months, however long we keep this operational, the less likelihood of us having to go out and get a commercial sponsor. And I haven't hit the sponsorship much over the last few weeks simply because, you know what? I'll be honest. There hasn't been a whole lot of action here. You know, I've made a few pitches to our listeners saying that if you own a company or know of somebody who owns a company that you think has a product or service that matches up well with our listeners or just would sound good on this podcast, to reach out to me, because I connect with pretty much everybody on our Twitter feed. And, you know, you could just direct message me and, you know, we'll try to work out a deal. I've had a few people ask, I'll give you a reasonable price point, reasonable offer. Hey, I'm not looking to make millions off this podcast. I do have a day job, by the way. This is a fun little side project that has grown by leaps and bounds. I never would have imagined it's growing to, you know, where it is. And this is something that I've only been doing for about 8-9 months now. But, you know, the opportunity is there. Again, you know, I'll throw it out there. If somebody does have a company, a product or service that you think matches up well with our listeners, I've got plenty of data. I've got plenty of information to tell you, you know, what type of audience is listening to this program and how often they'll hear your message. So I can give you a sales pitch and I'll still leave that door open. But clearly the easiest way for you to show your generosity, your appreciation for what we do here, is just click on that link and make your donation. So again, you'll see that once or twice. It'll pop up in our Twitter feed once or twice a week, I should say. And again, if you feel moved, whether it's a few dollars or a larger sum in advance, I thank you very much. You know, like I said, I'm not looking to make a lot of money off of this. And at the same time, there are some production fees, and it also takes time. You know, a podcast may be, you know, our podcasts have been running around in the 45 to 50 minute range for the most part. And nobody's complained about it. Everyone kind of likes the content that's in there. But for 45 to 50 minutes, you know, that's, you know, there's a couple of hours of production and research that goes into it. Believe it or not, it is not just me chatting away here. That's most of it. But there is a little thought and planning going into each show. So every few dollars helps here. And again, just keep an eye out for that on the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, and we'll have some more information on that. Now, speaking of our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, a very interesting question came up. Actually, not really a question, just a point from Sports Carter, one of our more active accounts, over, early last week. In fact, right after our podcast on 61 Tops came out, he said, I've been listening to a lot of the Wax and Gum Stains podcast this week. If I got to have one set from each year, 1982 to 91, it would be. And he goes on to mention his sets for Tops, 82, 83, 87, 91, Donruss, 86, 89, Fleer, 84, 85, Upper Deck, 90, and Score in 88. And we had a few people just kind of chime in on that. Shane Katz, 82 Tops, 83 Fleer, 84 Donruss, 85 Fleer, 86 Donruss, 87 and 88 Tops, 89 Upper Deck, 90 Leaf, and 91 Tops. And we decided to throw the question out there. Well, who else has some thoughts about this? So baseball and more. I could do that except Tops 83 and 85. And one of my favorite sets was 91 Fleer Ultra. And he was responding to Shane's list there. And I got to agree with you, 91 Fleer Ultra is one of the most underrated yet extremely laughably affordable sets still out there. Sports Talk or Talk Sports 16, 87 Tops for the win. You've got a lot of fans of that. Robbie T86 is not one of them, though. In fact, asking if he can skip 87 altogether and pick two from 84. Well, you know, this was a fan reaction poll question, I suppose. So, you know, you can set your own parameters. But he goes on to go with 82 and 83 Tops, 84 Fleer, 85 Donruss, 86 Fleer, bites the bullet and goes with 87 Donruss, 88 Tops, 89 Score, which I have an axe to grind with. I've never liked 89 Score, 90 Fleer, and 91 Tops. CompleteYourSets.com. Tops, top 10 sets, excuse me, based on design. And he doesn't go by years here, just a random assortment. 84 Donruss, 83 and 85 and 87 Fleer, 82 Tops, 87 Tops, 85 and 83 Donruss, and then 91 and 89 Tops. Pretty good collection right there. Sports Carter, by the way, responding back to the design question. 84 Fleer, 86 Donruss, 83 Tops, 89 Upper Deck, 89 Donruss, 85 Fleer, 87 Tops, 91 Tops, 89 and 87 Fleer. I hope you got all those. You can see, though, the question gets thrown out there and everybody has an opinion. So if you want to respond to that, either your top 10 sets by design or top 10 must-have sets by year. Now we had a, you know, a set of 10 for 82 through 91, but if you want to shift the window a little bit to 81 through 90, 83 through 92, whatever, you know, I'm always curious at your thoughts about that. Also, very interesting question from WaxPack916. As we were talking about Ted Bosfield, our random pull from the 61 Tops set, who is in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame and had a great story and still has a great story as he's alive and well in California right now. WaxPack916 asking, who is the greatest Canadian player? I'd vote for Larry Walker. Now, on the surface, Larry Walker seems like pretty much a no-brainer there. And in fact, Larry Walker was our random pull from the 92 Top Stadium Club podcast we did a couple months back. And certainly Larry Walker deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And unfortunately for him, there's the stigma of playing with the Colorado Rockies for several years. And people go, well, you know, it's the thin, dry air in Denver. The ball's always going to be flying out of there. Well, duh. But, you know, there's also a short right field wall in Fenway Park and the ball flies out of there. Yet there's still Boston Red Sox who are in the Hall of Fame. You know, God forbid Ted Williams ever had to play in Denver in his professional career. So, you know, I'm a big fan of putting walks into the Hall of Fame. But I did counter with the fact that, yeah, Larry Walker is definitely in the conversation, but you have to have Ferguson Jenkins in there. And Fergie is in the Hall of Fame. And people forget, you know, he was on some pretty bad teams. He was in Boston. He was with the Cubs, the Phillies, the Texas Rangers. You know, he bounced around a little bit at the end of his career there. But phenomenal player, Ferguson Jenkins. And in fact, he was one of the Cubs players who a couple weeks ago helped raise the pennant flags at Wrigley Field when they raised the World Series championship flag there. And chiming in on this, Autograph Blog says Russell Martin, Justin Morneau, and Joey Votto rank high on my list. I agree with Fergie and Walker as one and two. So you have the past players of Ferguson and Walker, and you have the current players or the more up-to-date players in Russell Martin, Justin Morneau, and Joey Votto. And time will only tell where those three kind of stack up. But, there, I would say, is a top five. And you can argue, you know, who should be one and two. Is it Jenkins or Walker, or Walker and Jenkins in that order? But I think probably in about 15 years from now, we'll have a better feel for where Martin, Morneau, and Votto rank in there. And it'll be interesting to see how that all shakes up. And also, you know, who the next Canadian-born player is that comes out and starts performing well, you know, again in the next 10, 15 years or so, and gets into that conversation. Now, speaking of the conversation about 61 tops, our friend 1967 Tops says, in regards to my commentary on the set, I agree the photos are really boring and bring the set down. Loved your discussion about it. Helps explain the set. Well, thank you very much. And, you know, that podcast was a little longer than we normally go, but, you know, a lot of explanations into, first of all, the 1961 expansion, and then the expansion on top of that of the top set, and why they had to keep the 61 top set pretty boring, because the teams were decided, or the draft was held in late December. But especially in the case of Ted Bosfield, you know, the Angels did the Indians a favor by drafting him, sending him back for cash, and then basically picking him up again a couple months later. So, you know, the poor people at Tops, this is the first Major League Baseball expansion. Granted, they had several series of cards that made up the 61 top set, but it was hard for them to really nail down, you know, what they needed to do for that set in terms of the expansion ball players, because A, they didn't know who was going to be on the team by the time the season started in April, and B, they had no idea what the logo was going to look like. They didn't know what uniforms were going to look like. So you had some pretty basic, boring, strangely cropped photos of players that were featured throughout the set, not just with the Angels and the new Senators, but also, don't forget, the old Senators were the Minnesota Twins. They didn't know what the Twins were going to look like. You know, now when you have an expansion team or a relocated team, basically, as soon as the news happens, you've got a logo, you've got artwork, you've got jerseys, you've got merchandise flying out the doors. Back in the early 60s, it was a completely different ball game, and you didn't have that advance notice of what everything was going to look like. So even though I'm not a huge fan of 61 Tops, that's one of the reasons why Tops had to play it safe. Although, as we'll discuss with 62, they decided to throw caution to the wind and come up with a much more creative set while still taking care of some of the unknowns going into the 62 season with the second round of expansion, this time in the National League with the Mets and the Houston Colt 45s. Ricky Hendrick going on the 61 set. I like the 61 set and have around 100 to 120 cards in building this set. Well, good for you, Ricky. And, you know, again, I need to, you know, stress that this isn't one of those 82 Fleer or 89 Score or 90 Donruss sets where you go, good God, this is an awful set, don't even bother buying it. You know, I like the 61 top set for a couple of reasons. One, because it's a historical set. And as I've mentioned, you know, going through the big old binder card sets that we look at, even if the cards are in bad condition, and you look at the Tim McCarver card, you know, it's pretty creased and pretty rounded with the corners. Even if they're abused, I like them. So, you know, I'm not going to turn down any 61 Tops cards just because I'm not as thrilled about the design. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I like them. But also, you know, there is a simplicity to it, even though I feel it borders more on boring than simple. And as I explained in the conversation with our good buddy Peter Steinberg, the 61 top set is plain. And Peter says, you know, I wonder if I'm in the minority here. I have always liked the 61 tops. As usual, wonderful, informative show. Thanks. Well, thank you very much, Peter. You know, I explained that, and this is something that we discussed in the podcast as well. When you look at the 61 top set in context with what came before it, all the great sets, and I'm going to start with 54 going up through 1960, all the great sets there. followed by the great sets. And I really thought, you know, one of the best periods of Topps baseball cards was 62 through 65 in terms of design and in terms of rookie cards and star cards, you know, the whole enchilada. They really, really hit the nail on the head in the early and going into the mid 60s. I wasn't so crazy about 66, 67, especially 69 Topps, although 69 Topps had the same challenges as 61 and 62. But you know, I really think 62 through 65 is just, you know, one of the premium times of Topps back when they owned the market. And they owned the market after buying out Bowman. They owned the market for 25 years. So, you know, they very easily could have just sat on their tails and just put out any old baseball cards. And in some years, it seemed that way. But I really thought they hit the nail on the head with a lot of those cards in the early to mid-60s. And 61, it was good, but not great. And that's what I have to stress, is that this is not one of those don't bother sets, which we had plenty of during the junk wax era. This is just one of those sets where if I had the choice, if you said, Matt, I can give you a lot of cards for, you know, for $20, here's a lot of, you know, 100 beat-up baseball cards, but you have to choose between 1961 and 1962, or 61 and 65, or 57 and 61. I'm going for the other choices other than 61. But again, if you give me a lot of cards from 54 through 65, I'm not going to sit there and take the 61s and go, eh, you can keep them. That's not the case. It's a good set, but not a great set. It's not one that I'm running out of the gate and tripping over my feet trying to attain. And then real quickly, you know, we had our Flashback Friday podcast this past weekend, all about 85 Topps, the Cyndi Lauper set, as I put it, as it's very emblematic in terms of design and colors for 1985. If you were alive in 1985 and you remember pop culture and pop music and the colors that were involved in everything that was popular then, you know, 85 Topps, as bizarre as it looks, kind of looking at it now, it's very much 1985. That's the best way to put it. Alex Hyde, flashback to my favorite set, 1985. It's like, you knew it was my birthday. Well, happy birthday. We didn't know it was your birthday, but we're glad that we could deliver at least that on your birthday. A couple other thoughts on the 85 top set. Zach STL, my first year of collecting, I could still taste the dried out stick of pink bubblegum. Oh, memories. I got three Gooden rookies in a pack that year. Well, good for you. So glad to bring back some memories there. And Tim Murray says, print the stats in red, they said. It'll be easy to read, they said. Yeah, that's one of the things about the 85 top set. The colors on the back, you have the ectoplasm green background on top of the gray cardboard stock, and then this kind of pinkish red stats. It was hard to read, but it still somehow worked. And that's one of the things that I really am amazed at, looking back at 85 Topps. All right, Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter feed. As you can see, lots of stuff to talk about. You can talk about our podcast, the players on the podcast. You can talk about the sets we talk about, or just anything in general about the hobby. We've got all sorts of conversations going on. And again, I ask you, please spread the word to all of your collecting friends. Even if they don't collect now, but they collected back in the day, tell them about Wax and Gum Stains. At least we've got a lot of conversations about some memories about the old sets, so we're happy to share them there. So Wax and Gum Stains, again, is the Twitter handle. And again, you can listen to Wax Ecstatic with new episodes on Tuesdays and Flashback Friday episodes over the weekends. Our new episodes can be heard, as well as our archive shows, at Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and now TuneIn and Stitcher. All right, so let's take a look at the 1962 Topps set. And this is one of my favorite sets because, unlike 1961, where Topps played it really, really safe because of the expansion that year, they really got creative in 1962. And I know some people are not fans of this design. And if you don't like 87 Topps, you're not going to like 62 Topps. Likewise, if you love 87 Topps, you'll love 62 Topps because they're practically the same card. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if when Topps was designing the 87 set, they hearkened back 25 years to the 62 set and said, hey, we got to do something like this. Much like I wouldn't be surprised in 1983 if they said, let's take a look at 1963. But we're putting the cart ahead of the horse here. Let's talk 63 tops next week. As for 62 tops, as we take a look at card number 167 here, the part of the 62 top set that really stands out is the design of the front of the card, not necessarily the back. We'll get to that in a moment. But the front of the card has this wood grain feel to it, the dark kitchen cabinet look to it, as you can see here, as that's the not just the background, but the border. And you have a very thin white border and then the player's photo. Now, what's also extremely unique about this set, not only the wood grain border and design, but in the lower right-hand corner, the player's photo has this peel-away effect, like they didn't apply enough glue to the lower right-hand corner of the picture. And where the player photo is peeling up, in a sense, that is where the player's name, his team, and position are located. And we'll get to that in a moment, but I have to point this out because this was groundbreaking for tops in many ways, because in the technology of 1962, and we've talked about this with 87 FLIR and the late 80s FLIR sets that set the mark for 3D technology before the technology was really advanced, and you had all of the 3D design that was implemented by a lot of sets in the mid-90s, and they still do it today. Well, with the primitive technology of 1962, if you will, by having this artistic little curling effect here, is it 3D? Not exactly, but it's close in the sense that it looks like you could, if you wanted to, it looks like you could take this picture of Tim McCarver and peel it off the wood here. And that is very stunning in terms of design. It's very advanced. And while I don't think I could officially call it a 3D design, it does have that 3D effect. Not like, as we go back to 87 FLIR, Kent Tekulve kind of sticking his head out the top of the card. But what you have here is almost like I said, you could just kind of peel this picture off. And if you could, there would just be this wood grain backing. You know, it would almost look like a cutting board here. So I have to give credit to Topps for coming up, you know, knowingly, unknowingly, with an incredible design element here that is still very memorable all these decades later. And again, some people don't like this kind of look, but I think it's very unique in that they tried to make the picture jump out at you a little bit. Where 61 Topps was very plain, and yet it featured a lot of picture, but a whole lot of nothing else. 62 Topps, you're saying, okay, we're still going to devote about 85% of the card to the photograph here, but we're also going to put this little design element that makes it kind of stand out a little bit. So I've always appreciated that. Now you've got the player's name, first name in black letters, last name in white letters, and then right below it in very small letters, you've got the player's position, in this case, a catcher, and then the team that he plays for. Now it's kind of hard to cram the name St. Louis Cardinals into this tiny little space. So top saving a little space and time, just going with the ST.L.Cards. So St. Louis Cards catcher all on one little corner here. Now, you could look at this and go, it would be a whole lot easier if they just put a logo on there somewhere. But again, let's go back to the conversation about expansion. And this was a 7-series set, much like the 61 top set. And there was a lot of unknown going into the spring of 1962 about who was going to be on these expansion teams and what the logos were going to look like, what the jerseys were going to look like. So this was the safe way Topps got through it. They just put the name of the team on there. And as for players who were drafted or who would likely be drafted by teams in the expansion draft, much like the 61 set, you see a lot of pictures of guys without their hats on. You see a lot of pictures with guys very up close. Sometimes the picture is taken from underneath the bill of the cap, so you're kind of looking up at the face of the player. So you have a lot of those awkward pictures once again. So Topps pulling out some of the tricks from the 61 set, but getting a little more creative with it in 62. And by the way, the backstory to the 62 expansion, I'll make this much briefer than the 61 expansion, but the teams in New York and Houston, the Mets and the Colt 45s, later named the Astros, of course, came about as kind of a, well, two-part approach here. First of all, the National League, not wanting to be outdone by the American League, wanted to make sure they had 10 teams, much like the American League was at in 1961. Now, the other reason why is because of Branch Rickey. Branch Rickey was trying to force baseball's hand into expanding to certain cities by creating the Continental Baseball League. And this was something that came out of the movement of the Giants and the Dodgers to California, of course, leaving just one Major League Baseball team in New York City. Well, there was all of a sudden competition, and the Continental Baseball League was going to bring a team to New York City, plus other cities that had been stiffed by Major League Baseball over the years. So they were going to expand to New York, also Houston, plus eventually Denver and Minneapolis and Toronto. The Continental Baseball League was going to be the first international baseball league. Well, as I said in the 61 expansion discussion in our last podcast, the American League got ahead of that in two ways. First of all, relocating the Washington Senators to Minneapolis, so they blocked that move there, and then feverishly adding the second Washington Senators as an expansion team in 1961, so that the National League couldn't just expand or relocate a team and take over Washington. So this little back and forth was going on, and the new Continental League started moving around cities as well. So they were going to add teams in Atlanta. They were going to add teams in Dallas. They were going to add a team in Buffalo, New York. So finally, with the agreement with the National League to expand to Houston and New York, that satisfied all the National League baseball fans, in particular, attorney William Shea, who Shea Stadium was named after. Settles him down. He's happy. Okay, we've got National League Baseball back in New York City. And that kind of killed any forward movement by the Continental League, because even though it would be nice to stick teams in Atlanta and Dallas and Toronto and Buffalo, the National League put a team in the number one city in the Mets once again. They covered their ass, the American League did, in Washington with the second Senators, and then by moving a team to Minneapolis, and Minneapolis was a pretty large metropolitan area back in the early 1960s. Oh yeah, and with Houston coming in too, basically the four plum cities that the Continental League could have moved into, it wasn't going to happen. And yeah, it would have been nice again to have Toronto and Denver and Buffalo, et cetera, but when you lose the big markets, you can't really survive with the smaller markets. And just ask future semi-pro or professional leagues like the American Basketball Association, the World Hockey Association, World League of American Football, the USFL. Once you get pushed out or marginalized in the top five or top 10 markets, it's a tough go by saying, hey, we're going to keep our league together with teams in Jacksonville and Memphis and Phoenix. You know, you can only go so far if you're not firmly settled into the New Yorks and the LAs and the Chicagos of the world. So the league would disband in the summer of 1960. The American League is settled in with their expansion and the movement of the first Senators to Minnesota. And then the National League has teams in Houston and New York, so everybody is finally happy. So Topps is put through the ringer once again with design and with trying to identify players and the teams they play for and what the teams look like. And while they played it very safe in 1961, they were able to get a lot more creative in 1962 while still towing the line. No logos, no airbrushed uniforms. You just had those strangely cropped photos on top of the very simple mention of the team that the player played for. Now, you flip the card over, and the 1962 card back is not a favorite for some collectors, but the good news for those who don't like it, this would be the last such design of the back of a Topps baseball card until 1971. And then after 1971, you didn't see any kind of card back like this, at least for a regular baseball card, you know, not like a team leader card or a checklist card or a World Series highlight card, but for just a regular base set player card, this was the second to last design like this. And like I said, it came back in 71. you haven't seen it since then. And as we look at the Tim McCarver card, you see the upper left-hand corner, you've got the card number and the Wild Wild West Topps logo in the baseball. You've got a little bit of a bio in the upper left-hand corner about the player. You've got a cartoon trivial tidbit in the upper right-hand corner. And then on the bottom, I'd say third of the card, you've got the old two stat line report there. You've got the major league stats for the previous year and then the major league stats for the career of Tim McCarver here. So this one is a lot more plain than some of the similar two-line stat breakdowns and cartoons and narratives that you saw, you know, mostly in the even year series, so 1960, 1958, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a difference there, but this was still kind of, again, Topps going back and forth between the cartoon and narrative and two-line report as opposed to the complete professional statistical report that you would see in the odd years, and you would see it again in 1963. And like I said, you would continue to see it up until 1971, and then from 72 onwards, that's what you would see in terms of the backs of the cards. Topps found a format that worked. So 62 Topps, one of my favorites, and again, because of the daring that Topps did, especially after how they played it so safe in 61, they really went out on a limb here in 62. And, you know, a very unique wood grain background, again, that 3D aspect of the players' picture peeling off here. Some good selection of players too. As I mentioned, this is Tim McCarver's rookie card, but also you had rookie cards of Boog Powell, Gaylord Perry, and Lou Brock. And of course, you had all of the star cards too. Mickey Mantle, the big card, Roger Maris, after breaking Babe Ruth's record, was card number one in the 62 top set. And as we know, the first card in some of these older sets were typically the most beat up because A, it came in the first series, so kids handled it more. B, if the kid rubber banded a stack of cards together and they were putting it in numerical order, that was the card that got used and abused a lot. Now, even though the design of 62 Topps is very attractive and very popular for most collectors, if you're trying to collect the set, it can be a little bit of a pain in the rear because the wood grain effect, when you got a little ding in the card or a little chip in it, it really stands out as opposed to a white border card. So it's very hard to find these in great condition. Also, there are some variations, most notably in the Series 2 of the 62 set. There was some kind of printing error where certain cards came out with a kind of a greenish tint to them. So even though there's really no glaringly different market for the green cards versus the other cards, still, you can see why some people are trying to collect both, so that they say they've got the regular base card and then the green card, if you will. Also, much like in the 61 set, there are special stamps that were included in a lot of the 62 sets. So you would find these stamps, and there were over 200 of them. So if you're trying to collect these, that's quite the task for you. But there are some collectors who feel that the set isn't complete unless you have all of these little stamps that were included in all the little 5-cent packs many, many years ago. So for some collectors, it's a laborious effort. But for others, this is a set that's pretty easy to get, fairly affordable too. I mean, it's still going to cost you several hundred dollars to either accumulate all these individual cards or, you know, buy a complete set that's in half decent condition. But it's a set that overall, much like 87 Topps, is well liked and loved by collectors because of the very unique design. And, you know, again, a total 180 from what Topps did in 1961. 61, they played it so close to the vest and they didn't want to ruffle any feathers, but 62 Topps, they certainly made an effort to put out a great design despite some of the challenges of not knowing which players were going to be involved with the Mets and the Colt 45s and what the teams were going to look like or what their logos were going to look like. And, you know, a lot of questions going into the spring of 1962, but I think Topps handled it much better than they did in 1961. Now, as for our random pull from card number 167, Tim McCarver, This is a guy who I don't think gets the amount of respect that he actually deserves, and not just as a player, but as a broadcaster as well. And when I say the amount of respect, it's really more from fans as opposed to people who work in baseball or in the media. Now, Tim McCarver was very fortunate to be born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. And I say very fortunate because Memphis is not that far from St. Louis, Missouri. So, again, in the pre-draft days of Major League Baseball, where you had scouts just scouring the country looking for the next big thing, you had plenty of scouts who would either scout the Memphis area or pass through the Memphis area. So as McCarver was becoming a pretty good player for his high school, Christian Brothers High School in Memphis, you had scouts catch on to what he was doing. But also, the Cardinals had their AAA farm club in Memphis. So you always heard the name Tim McCarver. You were quite aware of Tim McCarver, as opposed to some of our more previous polls, such as Ted Bosefield, Pee-wee Reese, Jerry Staley, you know, guys that were literal diamonds in the rough. Like, it's amazing that they even found their way to the major leagues. That was not the case for Tim McCarver. He was an outstanding ball player in high school. The Cardinals were, you know, watching him for a very long time, and he actually signed a professional contract with them in 1959. He was a free agent in the summer of 1959, plays a couple months in their farm system, then very quickly moves up to the major leagues. In fact, makes his major league debut just a few days, actually about 5 weeks before his 18th birthday. So he's a 17-year-old rookie playing for the St. Louis Cardinals. How crazy is that? Well, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, he's going back and forth between the minor leagues and major leagues. And finally, in 1963, he actually sticks around with 127 games that season. In fact, the funny thing is, even though his rookie card is a 62 Topps card, he didn't play a single major league game in 1962. So he had 50 games from 59 through 61, but skipped the 62 season, basically playing in the minor leagues, and then got called up for good in 1963. And he had a pretty spectacular career, especially his first stint in St. Louis. In fact, he was a two-time All-Star in 1966, 1967, was the runner-up for the MVP voting in the National League in 1967. Now, not to take anything away from Tim McCarver, but we should add that the winner of the NL MVP in 67, his teammate Orlando Cepeda, was such a slam dunk MVP winner. To be fair, he was a distant second, but still, yeah, you could say, hey, I basically got the silver medal in MVP voting for the National League, and that's quite the accomplishment there. He had 13 triples in 1966. It's not often you hear of a catcher hitting a triple in the first place, but having 13 of them, pretty phenomenal. Actually led the major leagues in that category in 1966. He also had a game-winning home run in the 64 World Series for the Cardinals, Game 5 against the New York Yankees, as the Cardinals not only stunned the Phillies to get to the World Series, but then stunned the Yankees in the Fall Classic. He would go on to win another World Series in 1967, appeared in the 68 World Series, which the Tigers came back to win, against a Cardinal juggernaut team. But, you know, he had a phenomenal time in St. Louis all throughout the 1960s. Hit for average, had a little pop in his bat too. Like I mentioned, had some foot speed as well. But he would be best known for his defensive play, and that's something that would play a little later on in his career. Although in the late 1960s, he was tagged up with Steve Carlton, a mercurial, to put it nicely, but dominating left-handed pitcher for the Cardinals. And he and Carlton had some magic together. They were a tremendous battery. But after the 1969 season, McCarver gets traded by the Cardinals along with Curt Flood, Joe Horner, and Byron Brown to Philadelphia for Dick Allen, Jerry Johnson, Cookie Rojas, as well thrown into that deal. Now, this is the legendary trade that Curt Flood refused to honor. He didn't report to the Phillies. And this starts the long and winding road eventually to free agency for ball players. In fact, 7 years, and Curt Flood was blacklisted and really does not get the credit that he was due for really taking the stand here. So the Cardinals have to kind of make up for Flood not going out there. So through a couple of separate transactions in the 1970 season, Willie Montanez and Jim Browning go to Philadelphia to complete the trade there. So the Phillies are definitely in a rebuilding stage here. They're starting to go up just a tad bit, and they pull off a phenomenal trade in 1972. They bring in, you guessed it, Steve Carlton, in fact, right after the 1971 season. The 72 Phillies were abysmal. I think they won 58 games that year. Carlton won 27 of them. Steve Carlton won basically 45% of the games that the Phillies bothered to win that year. No doubt why Steve Carlton was your Cy Young Award winner in 1972. Well, what's interesting is in the middle of the 72 season, even though Carlton and McCarver had something going, the Phillies traded him. McCarver, that is, to Montreal for John Bateman. So a lot of people don't know that before Gary Carter, there was Tim McCarver as one of many options behind the plate for the Expos. Well, they eventually move him to Boston. In fact, he's purchased by the Red Sox in September of 1974 and was actually potentially going to be a replacement manager for the Red Sox, who were struggling in the 1975 season. A lot of people aren't aware of that, but he very well could have been, and this is according to Peter Gammons, by the way, Daryl Johnson and the Red Sox struggling early on, and there was some thought that, well, we'll just take Tim McCarver, who by this time had become basically a backup catcher, and in fact, that was kind of his role after, I want to say, the 73 season. He was, you know, becoming more of a 1B catcher and a guy that you teamed up with a particular pitcher. Well, that doesn't happen, and McCarver is actually released by the Red Sox in June of 1975. Well, who comes swooping in again? The Philadelphia Phillies. And Tim McCarver continues his career as basically Steve Carlton's catcher and the occasional first baseman for the Phillies. But mostly, whenever Carlton started, that is when you saw Tim McCarver, and that's where he would play throughout the 1979 season. Now, the Phillies release him in 79. Okay, pretty much his career is done. He's starting to dabble in broadcasting a little bit, but Phillies are making a World Series push. Steve Carlton's the anchor of that starting pitching staff, of course. The Phillies need that catcher with him. So for a very brief time, in fact, the final 4 or 5 weeks of the 1980 season, McCarver goes back behind the plate and is Carlton's catcher for a handful of games. He wasn't included on the postseason roster, so technically he wasn't a member of the 1980 World Series team, but he helped the Phillies get over the hump there and eventually set themselves up for that moment of greatness in 1980, their first World Series after many, many, many years of abysmal baseball in Philadelphia. So with the 1980 season ending, he is released from the Phillies. His career is done. But one interesting footnote here, Steve Carlton is one of just a handful of players. I believe there's 29 players in Major League Baseball who have played for four different decades. Now, it sounds a little weird because Tim McCarver played 21 seasons over four decades. I'm like, oh, wait, how do you do the math there? Well, don't forget, he spent 1962 in the minors. Also, 1959 played just 8 games. 1980 played just 6 games there. But hey, it's a little more than a mini Minoso token game in 1980 for the White Sox. But Tim McCarver was there for 4 decades. So congratulations to him. One of the few that can do that, as he played a game in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 1980s. So he moves on to the broadcast booth full-time afterwards. First of all, starting off as a color analyst with the Phillies, and in fact, doing some games here and there for the NBC Game of the Week in 1980 before his career technically wrapped up. But, you know, once he hung up the cleats in 1980, then he went full-time for baseball, and he worked for the Phillies, he worked for the Yankees. Most memorably, though, he did a lot of games for NBC and ABC, and then later on, when Fox got the baseball package, he was working there through the 2013 season. Now, my two cents about this, a lot of people, especially the last couple of years that McCarver was doing color analysis, a lot of people didn't like him. They didn't like his criticism of certain players. They certainly recall, 1992, the little spat he had with Deion Sanders during the NLCS. He also said some things that, let's just say, were regretful in 2010, comparing Joe Torre's job with the New York Yankees. He was just kind of pushed out the door for Joe Girardi. Well, McCarver compared that to how the Nazis took care of Russian generals who didn't, follow the Nazi way early on in World War II. Anytime you're comparing anything to the Nazis or Stalinist Russian generals in World War II, you may intend for a good conversation, but typically the fallout's bad. So he had to apologize for that. But, he caught a lot of flack for, some less offensive remarks. Like I said, criticizing certain players, criticizing umpires, criticizing just the pace of the game. And a lot of this comes down to, when McCarver was done with his time at Fox in 2013. Let's remember, this is a guy who at the time was in his early 70s, talking to an audience. Yes, Major League Baseball's TV audience is typically older. I think the average age is like 55 or something like that. But you've got young people watching the game, and baseball's been struggling with trying to keep young people into TV broadcast and TV viewing for decades now. So when you have somebody who's 71 or 72 speaking his mind to somebody who's 32, there's a disconnect. And if you've ever wondered this, try having a conversation with your parents about politics or, what kids these days are doing. The chances are you're on a completely different page than they are. So that's what I chalk it up to. It's mostly just, Tim McCarver, late 60s, early 70s here, speaking his mind. And when somebody is at that age, they're just not going to connect to somebody who's in their 20s or 30s or even early 40s in most cases. So, it's something that you see in broadcasting a lot. The older people get kind of pushed to studio jobs, or they get back to team-oriented jobs as opposed to national broadcast. And, Tim McCarver's not going to be the last player that happens to. There's always turnover in broadcasting. It was, unfortunately, his time at the end of the 2013 season, and he called the Cardinals and Red Sox World Series at that time, and that was it. Now, afterwards, he continues his broadcasting career. He's continued to do games here and there for the Cardinals, a reduced workload, but he's been involved in the Cardinals broadcast over the last three or four seasons. He also has a nationally syndicated show called The Tim McCarver Show. He's had it actually for a long, long time, but it's an interview show, and he's been doing it for a very, very long time and still does it to this day. In fact, still runs a website, timmccarver.com. Should be mentioned that he is in the Irish American Baseball Hall of Fame. He fell well short of the Baseball Hall of Fame ballot many, many years ago, but the Irish American Baseball Hall of Fame has picked him up. And also, he is in the broadcasters wing of the Hall of Fame, recognized with the Ford C. Frick Award for broadcasting back in 2012. And he is alive and well, and like I said, still active in the broadcast booth, specifically with the St. Louis Cardinals for the occasional spot broadcast at the age of 75. So there you go, Tim McCarver, card number 167 of the brilliant 1962 top set. A big improvement over the 61 top set, in my opinion, and the opinions of a lot of collectors, as they were able to dodge a lot of the obstacles that Major League Baseball threw its way with expansion that they saw in 1961. But they were able to do a lot better in terms of design and just the complete package in 1962. Well, no expansion for baseball in 1963. In fact, that's something that Topps wouldn't have to dare approach until 1969. And, well, they approached it rather plainly then. But before the dull and boring days of some of the late 60s card sets came out, Topps was ready to put out another winner in 1963. And as I mentioned, it's a design that was very similar to what we saw in the classic 1983 set that collectors enjoyed. So next Tuesday on our new edition of Wax Ecstatic, we will bring you a look at the 1963 top set and a random pull from that collection. And then we'll be continuing over the next few weeks to take a look at some classic sets, some great designs, some of the best designs, in my opinion, from 64 and 65 before Topps kind of took the foot off the gas pedal a little bit in the late 1960s. And then, of course, starting to get pretty innovative in the early 1970s. So that's something you can look forward to in our new episodes over the next several weeks. Again, on Tuesdays, we have Flashback Friday editions as well. Just follow us at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter for the links to all of those new podcasts. Or you, again, can listen to us on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, or Stitcher. And don't forget about the Wax Ecstatic tip jar. We will post that link up on the Twitter feed every now and then. And we do appreciate any and all donations that are made to keep the podcast going and going strong. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you again for tuning in to another edition of Wax Ecstatic. We'll catch you next time.